The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Peace talks, like, what's the status? Who's in the room? Are they talking?
Very unclear in all of those. It appears that there have been talks have been continuing in Egypt, which seem to involve the Egyptians, the Qataris, and the United States.
We seem to be having...
least as far as we can tell. And the reality is that I think they're not getting very far at all. The possibility seemed to be that an extra effort was being made to get some sort of pause, at least, in time for the start of Ramadan, which is likely to be on Sunday. I think that is receding now, and I think that probably means that there won't be any further talks, or at least no real prospect of a ceasefire, maybe for some weeks. The only thing is it might change very suddenly, because at any stage the United States could, to put it bluntly, get tough with Israel, because it holds so many forms of control over Israel, particularly in arms sales, that it could change almost overnight. And that certainly happened back in 1982 when Ronald Reagan intervened during the siege of West Beirut. But the prospects for that, I think, are pretty low. So, candidly, I don't think we're too near to a ceasefire, even though one is very badly needed.
Now, obviously, the two sides have their own agendas and their own strategies, both Hamas and the Israelis. From the Israeli point of view, Netanyahu wanted to finish the job, in other words, to rid, I suppose, the armed elements of Hamas from Gaza. What do Hamas want out of all of this? Because they're not going to get the elimination of the IDF from the Gaza Strip.
Certainly not. I think if you go right back to the 7th of October, what Hamas was aiming to do then was, at a smaller scale, disrupt the idea of the Abraham Accords between Israel and particularly the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain and possibly even Kuwait and Saudi Arabia coming in. The idea of a rapprochement with the Western Gulf states, which would lead to very close links between Israel and Western Gulf business interests, and at the same time really sideline the whole Palestinian element. Hamas basically wanted to really damage that, and they have, I'm afraid, succeeded on that. The wider issue, I think, was they wanted actually to encourage some major conflict, even though it would involve huge loss of life on the Palestinian side. Their calculation was that the effect of Israel using its full forces in the open, as distinct from what Hamas would say they do rather quietly at present, this is all looking at it from Hamas's point of view, then essentially on that basis you would get a war in which people would see how Israel really does react. And of course, the audience here is not so much the Western world, but public opinion right across the Middle East. And again, the blunt truth is that is actually happening, and to some extent, in the wider world, Israel's actual political legitimacy is coming into question, given the huge loss of life on the Palestinian side. So I think that's where Hamas was coming from, and they probably, in their own way, think they've made some progress on that.
Now, the Israelis, in terms of allowing aid in, and it is there under their control, except from the skies, as we saw in recent days, they would say that when they allow stuff in, Hamas takes it and obviously feeds its war effort, according to the Israelis. Is that just a fig leaf, or is that true?
There will be some small element of that. It's inevitable, I'm afraid, given the way this war is so complicated and in a sense, integrated. But it is, I think, most observers would say, and certainly the UN would say, that this is basically an excuse, and that Israel could have allowed much more aid in earlier on. And in fact, if there'd been regular supplies of aid under sort of pretty careful UN control, then we wouldn't be in the position we're in now, because what I think Israel is doing is following fairly closely the so-called Dahir doctrine, which is that when you have an insurgency, which is extremely difficult to destroy without having a lot of your own people killed, then you go for more collective punishment of the wider population. And it was true to some extent right back in 82 in West Beirut. It was certainly true from 2006 onwards. In fact, that was when the term, the Dahir Doctrine, came into being. It was a district of Beirut, which was pretty well wrecked when the Israelis weren't able to essentially control Hezbollah and other means. And it's used to some extent in the earlier wars. Remember, we've had five wars in Gaza. The fifth, of course, is the huge one. But there were wars in 2008, 2012, 2014, and 2021. In those wars, something like 5,000 Palestinians were killed. 300-plus Israelis lost their lives, mostly military. And the Israelis did use extensive bombing and essentially killed, as I say, thousands of civilians. So it's a tactic which they feel they have to use, because you always have the issue that Israel was traumatized by the 7th of October, more than I think people recognize. It's also almost national trauma, just as people would argue very strongly that the Palestinians have been traumatized over the last 75 years. It's what makes this conflict so extremely difficult to bring together, to actually resolve, because you have two sides who are absolutely, in many ways, I think it's a weird term to use when you talk about a population being traumatized. But I think that is true, because even now, sort of 80 years afterwards, the impact of the Holocaust on Israeli thinking within Israel is still, I think, far stronger than people realize outside. Mm.
So starvation is a weapon of war.
Yes.
You know, like something from the Middle Ages.
Yes, I mean, it's been used in more recent wars on many occasions. I have to say, we tend to forget this. In fact, in some ways, terrible though it is, the way this war is being fought is not unlike other wars, including, for example, the conflicts in Myanmar and in Sudan that are going on now. The difference is we are actually seeing it. And that is partly because there is rather wider news coverage, not that good as far as Western papers are concerned. But the reality is you have one journal and one paper, and one news channel, which is being watched much more around the world than people realize. And that, of course, is Al Jazeera English, which is staffed by professionals. Many of them are basically people who used to work for the BBC World Service. And that is delivering multiple reports daily from within Gaza. And this is why you're getting a far greater coverage. And I think Hamas, in a way, recognizes that, because so much of this is actually a crude propaganda war. And the Israelis and the Palestinians are using it. Hamas is using it. And I think in many ways, the Israelis are finding it pretty difficult to handle at the moment.
Now, the question of propaganda, I suppose tribulations that are being suffered by the Palestinians at the moment are well documented by all the aid agencies. But someone said to me recently, why did I keep seeing the same child being carried out, you know, for weeks on end? Why was I seeing the same footage? So who's kind of organizing that kind of stuff? Because a legitimate news agency would say, no, hang on, we've shown that before. That was on, you know, October the 4th. And now it's October the 24th, and we're still seeing that image.
I think to some extent, I mean, I don't know the answer because I'm not a media expert at all in production. So to some extent, I think it's basically taking shortcuts, that you don't go into sufficient detail in terms of what you're showing. I mean, ideally, if you speak about using a term in these circumstances, then every sort of event in a particular day is used wherever possible using footage from that day. Or as some channels used to do, I don't think you do now much, you have a little caption at the bottom, library footage, making it clear that it's earlier stuff. But we don't see that now. So yes, you're absolutely right. It gives the impression that you're just seeing the old things repeated the whole time, which in a way they are.
Now, clearly it would suit Netanyahu to keep this going right through Ramadan, maybe give him the time that he requires, he thinks, to bring about the ultimate victory that might save his political skin. But in the meantime, the Americans, as you point out, have a role to play. The token food drop, 38,000 meals or whatever it was, only a drop in the ocean. But that presumably was intended to send a message as well.
It says, I think basically it's sending a message to the American people. It's very much sort of giving the impression that more is happening than it actually is. It's certainly welcome for the people concerned, but essentially what tends to happen in these food drops, if you've had food drop along a long beach, then essentially the fittest and most able young men are the ones who get it. And that does not mean always that it's going to get to the people who need it most. So it's a symbolic thing, if I think of rather dubious value in sort of realistic terms, but it is relevant as far as the United States is concerned for its domestic audience, because behind this, of course, is all the run-up to the 5th of November elections, with clearly it's going to be Trump versus Biden. Biden has problems here because many people in his own party are getting more and more angry at the way Israel is continuing with the carnage. But people know full well that Trump would be even more supportive of Israel than Biden is.
Yeah, well, of course, he said, if I had been in Biden's shoes, this would never have happened, nor would the war in Ukraine. And it probably would have been sunny every day and never
absolutely a cloud. And then there would always have been somebody to blame. But then, you know, this is how politics works so often, isn't it?
On that note, Professor Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, thank you very much for joining us. Now, still to come on the programme,
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.